Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name's Claire Clark. I'm one of the hosts of the channel, and today I am pleased to be talking to Elizabeth Catt about her fantastic new book, Pure America, Eugenics and the Making of Modern Virginia, which is just out from Felt Publishing. Elizabeth is one of my favorite authors. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for talking to me this morning, Claire.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us just a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. So I am a public historian and a writer. I am from Knoxville, Tennessee, and I fell into history and doing history sort of by accident. I did my undergraduate training in Latin and Greek to what? End. I had no idea. it turned out to be just an end. And so casting about and thinking what I could do with some of my training, I thought, well, maybe I will give history a try and maybe public history, which seemed aligned to work in museums and institutions like that. But once I got settled into the graduate program at MTSU doing public history, I absolutely loved it. I loved the questions that it raised about the past and the meaning of the past and the differences between what happened and what people think happened and sort of these battles over, you know, the control of the narrative. And I took off from there. I've been a public historian for about 10 years now. I currently live in Stanton, Virginia. Pure America is my second book. Now I write what I just generally think about as short nonfiction. So I specialize in writing almost pocket size works, serious works of nonfiction that are meant to be read in a sitting or two, that still bring some weighty matters to the forefront. And occasionally I do a little bit of work doing history consulting for organizations like the National Park Service. And that's me.
Well, thank you for the introduction. Yeah. I have to say, I love your first book, What You're Getting Wrong About Appalachia, was kind of like my guide when I moved to this region a few years ago. And I've recently started to get more interested. I studied a little bit of disability studies in grad school, but I've recently started to get more interested in the history of eugenics, and this book is a perfect guide to that history too, and especially the ways in which it's a living history still. Could you tell us a little bit about how you came to write Pure America?
Yes, so Pure America is a book that is very much inspired by my surroundings living here in Virginia. I live in a city, Stanton, Virginia, that has strong connections to the eugenics movement. It's a city that was home to a state institution called Western State Hospital that performed the second highest number of forced sterilization procedures in the state, and that's between 1927 and 1974. And the longest-serving superintendent of Western States, a man named Joseph DeJarnett, was also one of the most vocal advocates for eugenic sterilization in Virginia, if not the nation. And so when I first moved to Stanton, I lived just up the road from the former campus of that hospital. And for about 2 years, I observed, kind of as its neighbor, the transformation of this, what was then a derelict collection of buildings and land, including a very large patient cemetery. So I watched the transformation into what current city boosters call a luxury development, a high-end real estate development with a resort-style hotel. There's even more planned. So I watched as this development, intentionally or not, shed some of its more disturbing associations during that process. And I wondered where that history, which is the history of the eugenics movement, where that past and where those stories might live, since they had, in my opinion, been a little bit excommunicated from the new narratives of that institution and why it mattered. And as a historian that is fascinated by memory, the idea that it could be taboo in some ways to talk about eugenics in a place with these strong and obvious connections, that really fascinated me. I began to realize that I lived in a corner of Virginia where the tourism and culture economy's heavy hitters, not just this new development with a luxury resort, but also a very prestigious university, the University of Virginia, all these prized mountain landscapes, including a national park. These were all pieces of its eugenic past as well. So I wanted to tell some of those stories and connect some of those stories and also raise some questions about what the legacy of eugenics might be. I wanted to think about and write about what this modern city that I lived in and what these landscapes and institutions that I see every day and that I interacted with every day, I wanted to understand how they might be a part of that legacy. And this last element was, I think, the most challenging in writing Pure America, finding a balance between situating eugenics in a kind of remote past, but also trace it forward as a power and capital building enterprise that is responsible in some ways, I think, for the physical world that I live in today. And as you know, working with the history of medicine, there are many vantage points that we can use to talk about eugenics and show the legacy of eugenics. We can talk about immigration policies. We can talk about the continuing damage of white supremacy, battles over reproductive justice. We can talk about attitudes towards people with disabilities and the failings of our modern healthcare system. But I also wanted to show and focus on the physical endurance of those ideas in that world as well, because it provided such a unique way of starting to measure just how profoundly eugenics left a mark on this part of Virginia.
So can we just sort of back up a bit, and can you tell our listeners what is eugenics? Define it for us.
So it's complicated. Let's keep it simple, though. Eugenics is a science and philosophy that seeks ways of breeding better humans. Let's be blunt about it. Mm-hmm. This is a breeding science. It is interested in finding the best and brightest people who were thought to have superior genes. And it seeks to reward people who have superior genes for reproducing. And it seeks to punish or curtail people who are thought to have inferior genes from reproducing. Some people find it helpful to think about eugenics in terms of positive eugenics and negative eugenics. And these are not qualifiers or attributes. Positive eugenics means strategies aimed at encouraging people who are thought to have superior genes, encouraging them to reproduce. And this might include direct or indirect financial incentives, such as making it easier for them to purchase homes, to fill with those fitter families. Marriage counseling was once considered to be a form of positive eugenics. Negative eugenics, by contrast, is aimed at strategies to limit reproduction among people thought to have those weaker genes. State-mandated sterilization is one of the more recognizable forms of negative eugenics, and is one that I spend a lot of time talking about in my book. But strict immigration control is a form of negative eugenics. Even Jim Crow laws and policing of the color line can be considered negative eugenics. most of what I talk about in Pure America are those negative eugenic strategies. And those tend to take place before World War II. And just to oversimplify a bit, American eugenics begins to transition into more positive or passive forms of eugenics after World War II. So it's not surprising, I think, when we look at the 20th century world that popularized eugenics, that the people thought to have weaker genes, we're talking about all Black and Brown and Native people, we're talking about immigrants, poor white people, people with real or perceived disabilities. Those are the people that were most commonly labeled as having those inferior genes. These were people and groups of people that the state often resented helping survive. They were blamed for societal problems like crime. And they were groups of people that the state had a longstanding interest in controlling. Eugenics allowed the state to medicalize this desire for control, to frame it as a matter of public interest for the sake of the physical, the mental, and even the economic health of future generations. A really good example of this, particularly in the South and particularly in Virginia, where I'm writing about, is the transformation of those so-called one-drop rules from prevailing custom to hard science. So where white Southerners had long believed that any trace of non-white ancestry was sufficient to quote-unquote contaminate white bloodlines, in eugenics, they found what they considered a better scientific truth for their beliefs.
And you say this in the book, I think, if I'm remembering it correctly, that eugenics was a really efficient way to kind of just take racism up and package it up as a form of science, as scientific, following the Civil War. Is that right?
Yeah, so the beauty of eugenics for acolytes of eugenics was that it allowed sort of these good white middle-class people, and this is particularly true in the South, to look at their longstanding beliefs about race and also class as well and gender, and to medicalize them as a new form of disability. So it's an affirming science that basically takes a worldview that was very common, very, very, held by many people during this time, and infuses it with scientific truth. Eugenics was incredibly popular amongst wide segments of the population at the early 20th century. It was a highly participatory science. The strongest advocates for eugenics were very clever in framing eugenics as sort of like a democratic, participatory public science that everyone could take part in and everyone could share the benefits of. And they encouraged people to do things like fill out family genetic questionnaires and volunteer their medical histories to be sent to these clearinghouses. These nerve centers for the eugenics movement, they participated in things like fitter family contests where parents would bring young children to be measured according to new standards in child development. There was a lot of pop culture products that had eugenic themes. So movies, for example, that had, I'm marrying my sweetheart has weak genes. What do I do? Things like that, that were just a part of everyday life for people. And highly sort of accepted as a progressive science.
And so are genetic, are tests like 23andMe and those kinds of things, are those eugenic that we see today?
I would say so. I do open this can of worms in the book to some degree. This idea, this eugenic truth that who we are is written into our genes to some degree. I think the difference between genetic testing like 23andMe and what eugenicists believed in the past is that now it's acceptable and even sort of desired for white people to take a genetic test and sort of scrutinize their data for non-white ancestries. It adds to allure a personal mystery about themselves. Certainly in some cases, when we talk about white people claiming Native ancestries, there's a long precedent for trading on those kinds of myths in very, very specific ways that are quite shocking if you think about how eugenicists thought about things like blood quantum. So yes, I do tend to think that commercial DNA testing is to some degree trading on some darker aspects of eugenic thought, whether or not people are conscious about that. Certainly one of the things that I raise in the book too is this sort of weird thing that happens amongst sort of hardcore white supremacists who like to scrutinize their DNA tests to prove or to prove that they are 100% white, and sort of the researchers who have gotten into those communities and tried to think about ways that their findings have challenged or not their widely held beliefs about race and their own race and how race functions and in the broader world. So I have never taken one. I don't intend to take one. And certainly there's all kinds of questions which I don't even get into, but about how sort of like the state might access personal data related to health and genetics and things like that. So yeah, I think that eugenicists of the past would be overwhelmed to see that technology. They would probably be shocked at the casual way that we use it, but they possibly might have also liked the way that we are using it to affirm certain things about ourselves and who we are.
Elizabeth, my point wasn't to kind of get you to devolve your genetic history, but really to kind of point to that book's argument that eugenics isn't past; it's still alive and well today. And one thing you're really clear about in the book is you write that the story you tell is very much not a secret history; it's not a hidden history. It's very much a history that's sort of in plain sight and archived in established institutions. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that. So, I mean, why some of this history is pretty shocking. Why isn't it secret? Why isn't it hidden?
So I wanted to be explicit that this isn't a secret or hidden history for a couple of reasons. Most obviously, because the origins and applications of American eugenics is incredibly well documented by historians, by legal scholars, by individuals working in many, many medical fields, by disability rights advocates, by reproductive rights advocates, by journalists, by organizations. It is something that we know a great deal about. Its legacy takes us into fuzzy territories. And what I mean by that is, these profound questions about what does it mean to live in a country where this history happened, those are on more subjective territory. But in terms of understanding these ideas, their applications, where they originate from, to what end they were put to, we have some incredible material on that past at our fingertips. Second, eugenics was never a secret. Forced sterilization was never a secret. Eugenics was incredibly popular among white Americans, and there is broad support for population control at the turn of the century and beyond. This is not something that people are thinking about in secret. This is not something that people are ashamed that states are ashamed that they're doing. They're very proud that they're doing this work. And so what happens is after World War II, some of that enthusiasm is paled by associations between Nazi Germany and the eugenics movement and eugenic ideas. And so eugenics becomes more of something that is encouraging reproduction rather than eliminating reproduction of the unfit. But that doesn't mean that when we were practicing these things, and again, that's oversimplifying it a bit, that they were done in the shadows to any degree. Throughout the years from, 1927 to 1974, which is sort of the accepted dates for the eugenics movement in Virginia, there have been legal challenges from people who were victims of eugenics, from their advocates, from people working in sympathy with people who were thought to have disabilities or who were targeted by the eugenics movement. And so it's if we call this a secret history, we also erase to some degree the efforts of people to undo some of the harm that the eugenics movement has done. This is not a secret history in the sense that most of the resources I used for this book are expertly cataloged, meticulously organized by state institutions like the University of Virginia Libraries and Archives, the Library of Virginia. It's the amount of material that is available to study these topics is almost unreal, and it's almost too overwhelming. I think what is a little bit truer is that, people do feel uncomfortable discussing this history. It's history that doesn't make for easy consumption. It's hard to, there's no redeeming arc to this kind of history, except that we force these realities upon fewer people than we did in the past. But there's no, arc of progress to these kind of stories. The enthusiasm for which people participated in eugenic ideas implicates a wide variety of Americans and American leaders. And as you say, it's also a philosophy that still circulates today. In the moment we're in this global pandemic, we don't have to look particularly hard to see the shadow of eugenics almost everywhere. When we talk about whose lives are expendable, who has to work, right now we're having sort of this like exciting moment, but also stark moment where we're thinking about who are the first people who get to be vaccinated against the coronavirus. And so all of these ideas about whose lives have value in this society have never gone out of circulation, and we're still debating them today. And you could sort of slice any sort of current event and not have to look particularly hard to find the shadows of those questions that I introduce in 1924, for example. I decided to focus exclusively on eugenics for this book because there's fragments of the story in the first book I wrote that's just more of a general commentary about Appalachian history. And by far and away, those short references to the eugenics movement in my first book got, I think, the most engagement from people. I got emails from people wanting to know more. As a historian, sometimes it's hard, even as a public historian, it's hard to gauge how much the public is plugged into these things from the past. Certainly, if there's something about your identity that makes you, highly conscious of these episodes and this philosophy and the science and the continuation of it, you're going to know more about it than someone else. But I kind of like had to stand back from that and think, well, maybe this is something that we need to talk about more. And do it in sort of this way that makes it very local for me, to makes it a story not only about a people but a place.
Yeah, and so the way that you do that is through telling or trying to tell, trying to reconstruct, because it wasn't easy to do, despite all of the records, the history of Western State Hospital. And so could you tell us a little bit about, you kind of start with a figure who is, who's key. If anybody has read any of the kind of canonical histories of eugenics, you start with a person who's really key in those histories, and then connect that to Western states. So tell us, who is Carrie Buck, and then how does her life story sort of fit into your book?
Carrie Buck, who is also called Carrie Eagle and Carrie Dedamore, was a woman from Charlottesville born at the turn of the century, who is placed into foster care as a young girl after her mother was institutionalized as feeble-minded. In foster care, her foster parents treated her more like a maid than an adopted child, and when she was 17 years old, she was raped by the nephew of her foster mother and became pregnant. Hoping to avoid the scandal of her pregnancy, her foster parent sought to have her institutionalized at the same facility where her mother lived, and they were successful. Her institutionalization happened to coincide with a moment when the National Eugenics Movement was very aggressively pushing for a law that would legalize forced eugenic sterilization nationwide. And Carrie became their test case. And this test case eventually was heard by the Supreme Court, and she became the first person sterilized in Virginia in accordance with the newly affirmed law. And like you said, I wanted to start with Carrie because I think that if anybody knows anything about this history and connect it to a figure, it might be Carrie Buck, whose name is on the Supreme Court case Buck v. Bell, which has not been overturned, by the way. It's still technically the law of the land. Carrie was not at Western State. She was institutionalized and sterilized at a facility called the Lynchburg Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, which is in Lynchburg, Virginia, about 90 miles away from us. It was one of the state facilities where people could be sterilized after the law was affirmed. But the person who provided expert witness in her court case was a man named Joseph DeJarnett, who was the longest serving superintendent of Western State and a very vocal advocate for eugenic sterilization. So when we think about, and when I started thinking about eugenics, and I think this is maybe true of other people as well, when we think about eugenics and we think about forced sterilization, I find myself and found myself, when I talked about this in the past, when I was doing my training as a historian, for example, I would foreground the idea that advocates of eugenics thought people like Carrie Buck were unfit to reproduce, unfit to have full participation in society, unfit to control their own bodies. But understanding how Joseph DeJarnett thought about people like Carrie Buck, and I can see this through the testimony that he provided and also his writings about people at his own institution who were like Carrie Buck, is you start to understand that men like Joseph DeJarnett did believe that people like Carrie Buck were fit for something, and that was to provide compliant manual labor in perpetuity under supervision of the state, and to do so insured against pregnancy by a forced operation. And so that became what I wanted to foreground in this book. What these advocates of eugenics, like Joseph DeJarnett, who is, connected to this site in my neighborhood, what they thought these people were actually fit for. Because eugenics is always building towards a future goal. But what happens to people targeted? What happened to them in their present? When the state gave itself license to label these increasingly large groups of its citizens as unfit, what did that mean to them? And what did that mean to the people who sought to control them beyond subjecting them to an unwanted operation? So, for example, Carrie Buck in 1927, after her operation, she was paroled to a family who used her as a domestic worker. So much like the arrangement that she endured as a foster child. I think she was offered something like $5 a month, along with room and board, to essentially provide unlimited domestic labor to a family who were part of this arrangement because they explicitly sought out a young woman who had been institutionalized and who was thought to, might do well outside of it. And if she misbehaved, she could be sent back. So when I think about, when I came to think about Western State more intimately, labor was always at the forefront of my mind. At Western State, institutionalized workers provided a key source of labor supervised by Joseph DeJarnett, who once referred to his patients as nothing more than plows, as harrows. They provided an enormous amount of agricultural labor, which sustained a large growing operation at Western State for over four decades. They provided domestic work. They helped construct and maintain many institutional buildings. And so to circle back, I began to see eugenics from this vantage point, intertwined with the history of labor and the history of capitalism, in the sense that like DeJarnett and people like him saw the utility in creating a permanent underclass of sterilized workers whose labor was devalued because it was labor that was thought to be an exchange for a therapeutic or a corrective influence. And so that's something that, that I thought about a lot when considering Western State, particularly considering this transformation that took place from a former state facility to a privately owned enterprise that is valued in part according to the work that patients helped build and maintain.
So can you tell us a bit about the history of Western State? Just kind of trace the different, there are several eras, right, in this history.
Yeah, so I like to tell the history of Western State from the perspective of the the narrative of the facility that is talked about and is not talked about in, you know, in 2020, Stanton, Virginia. So the Western State that we talk about now that the site has been transformed into this new modern facility is the earlier history of the facility, this period where there was a more optimistic time in the history of psychiatric medicine, when efforts focused on humane treatment of patients, possibility of care, or at least some healing respite. This very interesting moment when architecture and medicine came into alignment through a kind of acknowledgement that one's surroundings could affect mental health and mood, and that these pleasant and beautiful surroundings had a healing potential. And this is perhaps even more true in a facility like Western State due to its proximity to the Blue Ridge Mountains. So this is the history that is foregrounded now, this association between a figure named Dr. Francis Stribling, who was an early superintendent before the Civil War, and his association with an architect named Thomas Blackburn, who was thought to be a protege of Thomas Jefferson. And their relationship in terms of constructing many of the hospital's earliest institutional buildings that are still standing. The facility is thought to be, parts of the facility are thought to be a very sublime representation of this marriage between architecture and psychiatric medicine, a bit like if anybody is familiar with the career of Thomas Story Kirkbride, the creation of sort of like humanity with an architecture for people confined to facilities like Western States. Of course, even that is a tad bit optimistic. It's true that a great architect designed those buildings, but we also have a history of enslavement at Western State. We also have Western State is a segregated hospital. It only served white patients until Virginia was desegregated in the 1960s. Gradually, we begin to lose that optimism somewhat, which eventually sees us at the turn of the century in a moment where communities like Stanton, small towns are sort of chafing under the weight of having to financially support patients and individuals within their community that can't support themselves. Institutionalization allows localities to relieve themselves of some of the financial burden of these individuals by institutionalizing them at somewhat remote facilities. And so the tenure of Joseph DeJarnett, who is associated with Western State from around 1905 to World War II, is a period of hyper-institutionalization, of confining more and more and more individuals, and the state reducing and reducing and reducing the expenditures they're willing to make to offset the care of these individuals. And that influenced Joseph DeJarnett's philosophies about eugenics, about coerced and forced sterilization. It influenced his ideas about institutional labor and his beliefs that patients should be put to work at the institution to offset the cost of their care and confinement. And so when I'm writing the history of Western States, I'm most occupied by this period, the DeJarnett period. And I have to say, it is an overwhelming thing to experience. As a historian, the archival records for this period are immense. One of the largest institutional collections I've ever seen, largely due to the fact that Joseph DeJarnett was a meticulous record keeper, almost to the point of obsession. And so, on one hand, it's very good because there's a generous record left behind. On the other hand, it's quite overwhelming to kind of have to pour through all of those documents and to understand, what is coming in, what is going out, who is coming in and who is going out of these facilities. This is also occurring. It's sort of like the time when the institution itself, in terms of land holdings, is about at its peak, and its patient population is about at its peak as well. The very short version of the remainder of Western State's history is that it like other facilities in Virginia nationwide, began a movement towards deinstitutionalization in the late 1950s and early 1960s, and the facility started to reduce its land holdings. It moved to a different campus and then a different campus again before it ceased operations entirely in that parcel. In the 1970s, and then the structure that we call Western State, that I call Western State, the original campus, became a men's medium security prison for a few years. And then it became a derelict collection of buildings that were controlled by the city of Stanton. And in 2006, I believe, the title was transferred to modern property developers who have ushered in this new phase for the campus as a modern real estate development with additional amenities like the hotel and resort.
You spent a night there, is that right?
I did. I've been to the site many times. In the last 2 years, so from about 2008 until about 2 years ago, it was primarily private real estate. So when they recirculated the buildings, they went to private owners, and there is a small sort of a condo community at the site. And then a couple of years ago, the hotel, the centerpiece, I think that the way that they think about it, opened a boutique hotel is what they call it, that's in the former administration building. So one of the oldest institutional buildings on the campus, and definitely one of the buildings that has this nice architectural pedigree that people around here love to talk about. And so on a couple occasions, I went to kind of hang out and have coffee or some food in the little restaurant that's there. I've made several trips to the cemetery. So this is, I mean, which is a whole separate kind of issue. And the fact that there are between 2,000 and 3,000 former patients buried in anonymous graves behind this development. And so in terms of giving this place a new lease on life, I think is always going to be complicated by the fact that people are buried and interred on the site. But yes, I spent the night at the hotel, and it's a great hotel. Mm-hmm. I can't really say too many, I can't say anything bad about it. It was architecturally, the restoration was magnificent. They're not, I mean, for a historic hotel, they're not particularly heavy-handed with the history. There's like minor interpretive touches here and there. There's, you know, like blueprints and former, you know, sketches, architectural sketches on the walls and things like that. It's, you know, architecturally focused interpretation. And it's, I mean, it's great. It's, you know, I recommend when people come to stay in town, I recommend it to them, because it's comfortable and it's nice and it's interesting.
But, and it's not, and it's, and the history is supposed to be tasteful, right? It's not like a ghost tour or something.
No, not at all. And if anything, you know, I'm not a fan of what they've done. I will say that. But, you know, I also can't blame them in some ways or fault them for taking this approach, because I think that they would argue, and I would, you know, be hard pressed to disagree with them, that there has been a very morbid history attached to this site. And, you know, if people outside of this locality knew Western State at all, they would know the eugenics past. They would, you know, there's ghost hunting sites and things of that nature that exist. There's photography sites that had focused on sort of like the previously derelict architecture and sort of like the spooky elements of this. So they're in some ways they're working against that and trying to balance out that perception with what they want to do, with what they want to do now to create this new a site with a new identity that is maybe in their minds a bit more balanced. But no, there's, you know, it's very much architecturally focused. It is supposed to be something that connects to the broader architectural themes and identity of the city. And that's why it was important to me that I give Western State's eugenic past, you know, an architectural reading. It was a bit sort of risky because obviously the person who reads this book and picks up this book might not, you know, be able to visualize what I'm talking about or put themselves to sort of feel the site in the way that I do, experiencing it every day. But it was, you know, this is something that's important to the people around me. I want them to connect with different layers of this site. And if they want to speak the language of architecture, then that is what I wanted to give them a reading of, to talk about these different ways that eugenics manifests in the way that the physical site has been arranged, just as there was a period where moral medicine, you know, guided this beautiful architecture that is well preserved and that we love to talk about. I believe that it's possible to see the eugenic past in that architecture too, if you are someone who is interested in paying attention to things that patients built and provided institutional labor, patients designed, patients maintained, patients provided the work and care and attention that allowed those structures to be so well preserved into the present.
So can you tell us a little bit more about that? How did the promotional material at the inn that you stayed in match up with the research you were doing for your book? Because you spent a night there while you were working on the book, right?
Yeah, so my publisher Anne came down, and you know, my partner and Anne and I, we all set out to go and spend the night at the hotel. And you know, I'd been visiting the site for quite a while prior to that, even inside and kind of, you know, like sulking around the cemetery a lot. And I it was exactly what I thought it was going to be. It was a beautiful place that leans heavily on the architectural pedigree and what the architecture says about this period of moral medicine that existed under this specific superintendent. Nothing really less, nothing really more. You have to understand that in Virginia, even like the most tangential association with Thomas Jefferson is just worth its weight in gold. So, of course, they're going to lean heavily on the idea that these were structures in part designed by proteges of Thomas Jefferson. This was a period of optimism in psychiatric medicine. I think some promotional material used the phrase resort style asylum, so that was, that's what that's the history that they're leaning into at the site. There's a 100-year gap in that history, which I was very interested in. And, obviously for what I'm writing about, cause that encompasses the eugenics movement, but it raises so many questions about, layers of the past and, what can we say happened in this time period? If it's not, does this have a story that reflects this era if you're not telling it? So there's very subjective questions like that. I was interested in seeing if I could find some resolution or waypoints to sort of think about those a little bit more. And that's why I just kept going back and back and back to the cemetery, because I think, in some respects, if you want to find out what happened in that 100-year gap, you sort of have to start there in the cemetery, because at least you can say that people died there and were buried there. And unfortunately, it's still to my knowledge, I think is part of the campus that has been marked off limits. So I don't know what the future holds for that, but. There's very little that anybody can do about any of this, because it's a private enterprise that controls it. They control the narrative of it. They control the identity of it. And as much as I dislike things like that, I do have to admit it raises some interesting questions about the identity of places and how the past becomes tourism and branding and things like that.
And De Jarnet, that period's in the gap. That's just, is that right?
Yeah. There's nothing about the eugenics movement that is really interpreted or acknowledged at the site now. It's hard to, I keep going back and saying, I understand why they don't. But at the same time, it is the truth. There's nothing about the eugenics period or DeJarnett's tenure that is really acknowledged at the site today. And again, that's why I wanted to inject some architectural history into my interpretation of, into my interpretation of Western state story to talk about the fact that patients did build some of the institutional buildings and maintain some of the institutional buildings. And there, the marks of their labor are all throughout the facility, even as it stands today.
And it's not just architectural history that you draw from. I'd like to talk a little bit about what are the sources that allow you to read the buildings in the way that you do and to read them so differently from the way that the promoters do, right? So you're obviously inspired by the physical environment, drew inspiration from your public history training. But this book also, and I hope for anybody who, I hope listeners will pick it up. And then if you get more interested in eugenics, there is a legit list of secondary sources in the back. And as you said, the archival research was extensive. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about what were some of your sources for inspiration for your interpretation of Western state history.
So, one of the funniest things that happened is when I moved to Stanton, so I'm not from this area, but my partner is. And we did the thing where, he wanted to move back home and I was like, yes, let's do it. And he was like, well, we can't live right in my hometown and we have to live up the road a little bit. I was like, okay, that's good. And I drove past Western State the first time and it looked so good. I mean, there's like bustling activity and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, that is the Western State, right? People are going to live there. That's so strange to me. And so I started reading, anything that had to do with the history of Western State. And I'd read, you know, quite a bit about the history of eugenics when I was training as a historian. And I just returned to those texts because I felt like my mind was starting to slip a little bit, that there was like maybe a different asylum in town where all this bad stuff happened, that people still were allowed to talk about it. And so I read, you know, I just like devoured anything that Gregory Michael Dorr had written and Paul Lombardo had written. They're two of the most, foremost experts on the American eugenics movement in Virginia. Both do incredible work in terms of understanding the legal history of the eugenics movement. I just returned to so many secondary texts that I'd read as a student and kept going and going and going, just because I felt that silencing effect of living in this place and feeling like this was like forbidden knowledge. And that's just my perception. I'm not saying that the city was sending off like clear, strong coercive signals that we couldn't talk about this. It was just sort of like I felt that trepidation, and so I responded to it by doing more and more reading. And you know, again, I have to say that the Library of Virginia just did they have a phenomenal job organizing most of the records of all these state institutions. There's five in Virginia. The records are meticulously organized. The finding aids are incredible. You could spend years kind of understanding all of those documentations. I relied on, scholars like Katrina Powell when I looked further afield and started to examine what might be happening in terms of the eugenics past within the Shenandoah Valley, the wider Shenandoah Valley, particularly some of the history, the eugenic past that is reflected in sort of the history of the national park sites in the area and the displacement of mountain families. Sue Curiel also wrote some fantastic material about the regional eugenic past outside of Stanton. And I have to say, another thing that was really inspiring, you know, in terms of history being written was not actually about eugenics at all per se, but, you know, I'm formulating the ideas for this book as the debates about Charlottesville's Confederate monuments are taking place in 2016 and beyond. And I'm seeing, you know, the questions that people in Charlottesville, my colleagues and friends and acquaintances in Charlottesville, the things that they're debating about, the questions they're asking about their past and the terms that they want to know their past, these new terms they want to know their past on. And, I drive into Charlottesville and sort of catch up with people. And then, you know, I drive back to Stanton and think like, why it would be so great if there was, you know, sort of like these, if there could be a space where we could ask similar questions about the local past here as well. And so I was very much inspired by this sort of community-led public history efforts that were taking place in Charlottesville in the wake of, you know, the opening the decision about what to do about the two Confederate monuments in that city. And so all of these sort of things are kind of collating in the way that structurally I organized the book and why I wanted to anchor it so firmly to the physical environment too.
Well, you synthesize just an amazing amount of material, but you make it look easy. And so the book is just such a joy to read. I know we've taken up a lot of your time, but I want to make sure that we get to the end. So tell us how the ledger book from Western State Hospital relates to the book's conclusion.
So the ledger book was such sort of a powerful, maybe metaphor that I held in my mind because, again, you have to understand that Joseph DeJarnett is a hyper-enthusiastic collector of records. everything goes down in a ledger book, whether it's how many apples he eats or how many, you know, patients were working in the field, how many pounds of cabbage, how many pounds of pork his farms produced. Everything is meticulously organized. And so I thought, what would a ledger book of Western State look like now? How do we value things like the cost of the human labor that it took to maintain a physical site like this? How much is, you know, how much is the land worth because laboring patients sloped it and made it useful for farming? Things like that. And most emphatically, the ledger book comes into play because in 2015, the state of Virginia authorized reparations or compensation for survivors of eugenic sterilization, up to $25,000 for survivors or their estate. And they did, you know, that's an actuarial decision, I think, about it, because in Virginia, unlike some other states, the peak of eugenic sterilization happened in the 1930s and 1940s. And so I think the state of Virginia was banking on the fact that many of the people who were targeted by these sterilization campaigns were deceased. And so I think it paid out 28 claims to date, when that book was written. So that was current as of last year. And when you think about it, it's such a paltry amount for that 50-year history. And I don't have any sort of grand pronouncements about what justice looks like in this scenario. I think certainly the way that Virginia managed its compensation program and the way that North Carolina managed its compensation program has lessened should another state choose to do something similar. And I do hope that California, which had the most forced sterilization performed, about 20,000, certainly goes down a road where they can bring some kind of financial justice to living survivors of eugenic sterilization. They would also incorporate elements of racial justice as well. But I think that it's just important to acknowledge that justice in this case was not done and can never be done. We can never live in a world where something like Western State and a person like Joseph DeJarnett and a campaign like Virginia's eugenics program didn't happen. And so we will always be unbalanced in that respect. And I think that is a humane note to end on for my book, certainly, because what eugenicists were ultimately chasing was some kind of balance that they could achieve, knowing that the fruits of their labor was always going to be denied to somebody else, a future generation that would, you know, be born and find the slate wiped clean of all the debts that quote unquote unfit people inflicted on society. So I'm saying, this is me saying that it's not been balanced. It will never be balanced. And if it starts with an acknowledgement of that, then that's a fine place to start, I think.
It's a beautiful ending, and it does leave open the question of what is to be done next. Whether the end of the book is a call for more or better reparations, for present day criminal justice or labor reforms, for changes to the way we do historical preservation, or
all of those things,
academia, you know, universities run themselves, the way we teach medical students. Yeah. It's that was what I got, that it was all of those, that the implication was all of those things.
And the fact that they're connected too. The most important achievement for this book is just showing all the subtle but also sometimes very obvious ways that all these systems of power are connected. I don't mind saying that I think one thing to do is just make sure that people don't die because they don't have access to basic health care. We are in a moment where some people might argue that our moment is a moment of passive eugenics, where we don't have the positive eugenics of the past, and we don't have the negative eugenics of the past, but we have a system where we allow the people that the state cannot assign a value to, we allow them to suffer and die through indifference and through rationing of resources. And so to resist that is, a way forward, and would certainly help people's lives immeasurably. Especially, we don't even have to have this conversation because we see what is going on, with the pandemic and the way that people have suffered and the way people are concerned about their health care and knowing that they could get sick, but maybe even worse for some people is that they could go bankrupt because they got sick, that they don't have control over their bodies because they don't have control, because the resources that they need to take care of themselves and to make choices have been rationed away and for no good reason either. And so I think that, when I talk about this book, not knowing when I wrote it that it would arrive in this moment, yes, that is, I'm happy to say that is my lesson. Let people make decisions about their own health and their own bodies.
Well, it is definitely, it's an applied history, and the fact that it applies to a historical moment that you had no idea was coming is all the more remarkable. Okay, we really have taken up a lot of your time. So I'm just going to ask you one more question. What mm-hmm. are you working on next?
Nothing. I'm a person, my mental health and my mood is so variable from day to day to day. I'm basically getting through one day at a time. Like a lot of people, I've been very fortunate to be able to make a small income from writing. I don't know if I'll be able to sustain that. Just being truthful. There's so many kind of decisions and realities that need to be recalibrated. We're going to lose an incredible amount of creative talent now. Even if I'm not among those people, certainly the environment in which I try to produce work will be so much different and so much more shallow. In that respect, losing community and losing resources and losing that spark is going to be something that I don't know if I can adjust to. So I'm playing it by ear, and hopefully better things are on the horizon, but we'll just have to see.
Well, I hope so, because Elizabeth, I certainly want to hear more from you. I want to read
Thank
more.
You.
I guess I have to wrap up now. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for inviting me.